That was a section of Farther Unknown from The Terror End of Beauty, the latest album by Harriet Tubman. Harriet Tubman bassist Melvin Gibbs is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to episode 32 of the Burning Ambulance podcast. We're part of the OSIRIS podcast network, which includes over 24 shows on a wide variety of subjects. If you visit osirispod.com, you can look through their whole catalog and see what else appeals to you. If you want to become a supporter of Burning Ambulance on Patreon, you can do that for just $5 a month at patreon.com/burningambulance, and for that you'll get exclusive content, including extended episodes of the podcast, subscriber-exclusive articles, stuff like that. Melvin Gibbs is a veteran bassist who's been blurring the lines between jazz, funk, rock, dub, and avant-garde music for 40 years. He got his start in Ronald Shannon Jackson's Decoding Society and the band Defunct in 1979 and 1980, and moved on to work with guitarist Sonny Chirac in the mid to late 1980s. He was also an early member of the Black Rock Coalition and led his own rock band I&I in the early 90s. In 1994, he joined the Rollins Band and played on their albums Wait and Come In and Burn. In 1998, Melvin formed Harriet Tubman with guitarist Brandon Ross, who's worked with Henry Threadgill and Wadada Leo Smith, and drummer J.T. Lewis, who's played with everybody from Herbie Hancock to Lou Reed to Vanessa Williams. They made two albums in 1998 and 2000, and then kind of went into hibernation until they re-emerged in 2011 with a live record, Ascension. It was an adaptation of the John Coltrane piece of the same name. It was recorded in 2001, but never released. Their first new studio album was Araminta, a collaboration with Wadada Leo Smith that came out in 2017 and created kind of a sensation across the critical spectrum. Rock and jazz writers both seem to like it a whole lot. The Terror End of Beauty, which came out at the end of 2018, is a very different record, but it's still got the same core qualities as their previous work. It's a mixture of this kind of hazy post-rock sound with some extremely heavy hard rock and metal riffs, but they're emphasizing the heavy side more than they have in the past. But talking about Harriet Tubman alone is just barely scratching the surface of Melvin Gibbs' career. I mean, he's worked with John Zorn, he's had a longtime creative partnership with Ardo Lindsay, through which he's worked with a number of Brazilian artists, and he's just got much, much more going on. In this interview, I talked to him about his time with Ronald Shannon Jackson, with the Rollins Band, with Harriet Tubman, with John Zorn, and much, much more. I'm going to play one more piece of music. This is Liar by the Rollins Band, and then you'll hear my conversation with Melvin Gibbs.
Alone, in darkness, in seclusion. Yeah, I know. You've been out there, tried to mix with those animals, and it just left you full of humiliated confusion. So you stagger back home and wait for nothing. But the solitary refinement of your room spits you back out onto the street. Now you're desperate and in need of human contact. And then you meet me and your whole world changes. Because everything I say is everything you've ever wanted to hear. So you drop all your defenses and you drop all your fears. And you trust me completely. I'm perfect in every way. As I make you feel so strong and so powerful inside, you feel so lucky. But your ego obscures reality and you never bother to wonder why things are going so well. You wanna know why?
How did you meet Ronald Shannon Jackson, and how did you join that group?
How I met Ronald Shannon Jackson was I was in a group that rehearsed up on 125th Street at the Dance Center that was called the Band of Music. And the Band of Music was led by a drummer named Adrian Day. And I didn't know who Adrian was. I don't even remember how I ended up getting his number. I ended up getting in his band. But after a while, I got a couple of rehearsals in. I found out that drums weren't his main instrument. He was actually a percussionist. And it turned out he was the percussionist in Primetime at that time. And it turned out the guitar player in the band was Vern Nix. You know, and it's funny because I didn't put two and two together that it was the same Vern Nix, you know, because there used to be a music store in the neighborhood. I used to always go in and look at the Dancing in the Head album cover, you know, which had the kind of reverse face thing. I don't think I had a copy in the house at that time. And I remember I was in there one day and I was looking at it. I was like, it's time for me to buy this album. And I looked on it and I saw his name was on it. I was like, oh, this is the same guy. So that's kind of how I met those guys. And I was in there after rehearsal one day and Vern said to me, Melvin, I think you can play harmelodic. I'm kind of like, what's that? And he pulled out a couple of charts. So I guess this was after rehearsal because Adrian must have been gone by that point. You know, we were up in the dance space. Went through a few charts and he said to me, hey, my friend Ronald Shannon Jackson is looking for a bass player. I'm going to give him your number. And that's how I started playing with Ron.
What were the, like, what can you describe the roots of that kind of no wave post Primetime New York funk sound? Because there was a lot of it. There was Defunct, there was Decoding Society, there was Blood Ulmer's bands, all kind of working in a similar territory in the late 70s, early 80s, even Arthur Blythe to some degree. Was involved with that. So, like, how much did you have to do with the evolution of that sound and that kind of vibe at that time?
Well, I mean, from my perspective, I mean, other people are going to have other perspectives. There are three big buckets for that. You had Arnett and the people around Arnett, which he was living in Soho at the time. You had Blood Ulmer, who was also living in Soho at the time. And you had the St. Louis Bag crew, who was living in the East Village. And the overall sort of Uber connection was the Loft Scene, you know, because that was towards the end of the Loft. That was, I guess it's safe to say, because I think a thing a lot of people don't know is that all the gentrification process in New York City started back then. Soho at that time was where artists lived, you know, mm-hmm. And there was a lot more free space back then. So there was a lot of lofts. There was a lot of lofts in Soho, Tribeca, you know, even up into the 20s. And that was the backdrop for this kind of crossover. And I think it was just a generational thing too. It's kind of like, you know, when they started bringing the young guys in, you know, we came in with our music and, you know, I think Arnett made a more, from what I understand, Arnett kind of he'd already made the connection, but the Joe Juca thing is what actually kind of made him switch up and think about just straight up having the kind of circular funk rhythm thing going, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think for the St. Louis guys, a lot of them, I mean, you got to remember Lester was already up in playing with Fontella. They had a different relation to pop music than a lot of the New York jazz guys did, you know. So they didn't mind the kind of collision and crossover. And when guys of my generation came up, we just kind of just started, we brought in the music that we grew up on and kind of interfaced with them, and it became this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as that, I mean, I can't take responsibility for, actually I can. I will, because Defunct was a lot, I mean, you know, they didn't write any songs for a while after I left the band. I mean, all of those songs, that first batch of songs is all my bass parts, right? But as far as what Arnett or, you know, some of the other guys were doing, I mean, they obviously had, these guys are all thinkers, you know what I mean? They spend time thinking about music. So for one set of guys, we were kind of vehicles for the other set of guys. I think for the no wave scene, yeah, I think we definitely kind of had an effect, you know, as far as how that music evolved. Mm-hmm. Because their whole thing was, I mean, they were anti everything except funk. That was the one thing they were trying to embrace, you know. And I don't know if it was because of the circularity of it or whatever, but yeah, I think to answer your question as far as what effect I personally had on the music, I was, you know, I mean, I guess my one, I won't say claim to fame, the one thing I can actually say that I know I had an effect on is Flea himself told me that the first song that Chili Peppers wrote, they stole one of my bass parts.
Mm.
So that's the one thing I can personally say.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
What
about how the actual sound evolved? Because this was something that I was talking about, I think, on Twitter a while ago, was that sound, it had this really weird sort of clanging, clattering sort of thing, like the guitar tones and the ringing snare drums and the whole production of that kind of late 70s, early 80s New York jazz funk was very harsh in a
yes,
way.
Yes, it was very harsh. And it's funny because I didn't always like it at the time, but whatever. Because, you know, I came up with a different thing. I think part of that was just, you know, a lot of this stuff that we think of as just being, you know, musical innovations are just kind of technological constraints.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was just how the studio sounded back then, and that's how the engineers recorded. And, you know, there was a big dividing line between engineers and musicians back then, so musicians just deferred to the engineers when in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that a lot of it was just, you know, technical, just the way the guys recorded in the studios at the time. And I think the one thing about that time sonically is that, and part of that, thinking about it now as a producer, is because one of the big things of that era is that the drummers rarely use their cymbals. That just wasn't a thing, you know. And I remember JT told me he went to go audition for Blood, and the first thing Blood told him was to take his cymbals away. You know, so. And since that being part of, without the cymbals, then those other kind of, you know, high-end sounds are going to take more prominence in the mix. So that would be part of it for sure.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You know?
Now, working with Shannon and working with Sonny Chirac after that obviously put you into Bill Laswell's orbit to a degree. So
yeah.
Was there ever, what was the relationship between the two of you? Because my impression is that you're more interested in being a player, and he was always more interested in being like a producer and a mogul and whatnot than just making music.
Well, I mean, this is something I don't really talk about a lot, but whatever, you know, I guess me and Bill are cool now. I think you can't really talk about this without talking about racism and talking about the context of New York City in the 80s. Because I think now, because of the way the music business is now, everybody's producing their own records, or they're doing kind of doing what they wanted to do, mm-hmm. what they want to do with their music. Back then, you really needed a co-signer, a sponsor, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And to put it even more blunt, you kind of, if your co-sponsor was like a white dude, that was even better. That's the fact. And, you know, I don't think Bill would deny that fact.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So the fact that Bill is in fact a great producer, you know, is one thing, but the over fact was that he was the person that everybody trusted with the budgets.
Mm-hmm.
So consequently, everything kind of started filtering through him.
Yeah, no, I mean, so, I've interviewed him, and he's talked about the fact that he has a talent for finding people who will give him a pile of money.
Yeah.
You know, and
so that so and since that was Bill's talent, you know, and at that time, and still not enough, wasn't mine, you know, things shook out the way they shook out, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So again, this is all kind of the, you know, to a degree backdrop of why the BRC started, you know, in addition to backdrop of why the ACM started. All of these, all the African-American organizations, they all have the same genesis of that era. You know, it's like you can't really get at the resources, so you have to pull together to create a sort of a focal point where the resources can be aimed.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the 80s, Bill, in New York, Bill was that focal point, you know. So that's what I'll say about that.
Mm-hmm. So how did you join the Rollins Band? Were you invited? Did you audition? How did it, you know, did they have other candidates? How did that work?
Well, I mean, the backstory of that is, you know, I had my own band that I co-led for years, I&I.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I&I had broken up, and I was just kind of trying to figure out what next I was going to do. I&I was signed to Sony. I was still signed to Sony at the time. And I got a call from Chris Haskett. I guess Vernon gave them my number. And the first time they called, I was kind of like, I'm not interested. Because I had a deal, you know what I mean? It's kind of like, I'm kind of like, you know, I've been hustling that I&I for years, and I kind of didn't want to, you know, I wanted to do my own thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out that my partner at the time was good friends with Henry Zainoff. And I don't know, since people who aren't in the music business, I'll explain what A&R is. A&R is artists and repertoire. They're the people that are responsible for shepherding a record through the process, the label process. They're responsible for getting the bands on the label. They're responsible for overseeing the record and getting the record released. So my partner at the time was very close with Henry's A&R, and she kind of basically wore me down. And I was kinda like, she basically said, go, it's, you know, it's gonna be fun, well, don't take it so serious. So for better or worse, Chris called again, and the second time I told him that, you know, yeah, okay, you know, I'll go do it for fun, we'll see how it is. And we went in there, and then like 5 minutes in, I was kind of like, this is great. I think it was kind of like pretty instantaneous that it worked immediately. And there were a couple of other candidates. I don't know them. I don't know who they were. But I mean, I kind of left out of there kind of knowing that, you know, this was something, if I wanted to do this, it was something I could do.
Uh-huh.
And they asked me, you know, I guess they went through the rest of the people they had on the list, and then they called me back and said, hey, you know, let's do this.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, I'm in. Yeah.
So how worked out, or how far into the Wait album were they before you came on? Like, did you, Chris, and Sim all kind of work the music out together, or were they already presenting you with ideas? What, you know, what was the story?
Well, I'll put it this way. Once I decided to go ahead and play with the guys, I kind of just sat down and thought about, okay, what should I do? What riffs do I want to, you know, what do I want to throw out here this day? So I worked up a couple of riffs in the house. And the first thing we played when we got together was the riff that became the song Civilized.
Mm-hmm.
We played the riff that became Fool. That was another one I had worked on. We played that day. I guess the thing that became Wrong Man, we also played that day. That Chris brought that in. And a couple. I guess what I'm saying is we probably wrote the basis of about half the records in that first jam session.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we worked the rest out over time. I remember we worked out, we were rehearsing at in East Village at that time. And yeah, we worked the rest of it out during the rehearsal process.
And what was the relationship between the band and Henry? Like, did you guys hand him music and he'd write lyrics? Because I know he doesn't play an instrument, but he has really big ears. So I imagine that he might have had ideas of his own as well. So did he contribute at all in that sense?
Well, I mean, interesting question. Basically, he just wrote the lyrics. I mean, he had ideas about music and that he would, transmit to us. Mm-hmm. But he was pretty comfortable with just letting us do our thing and then like, okay, that works for me, that doesn't work for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the stuff that worked for him, he would write to.
Yeah, yeah. So was it a quick process in terms of putting the music together, or?
I mean, it's a while now, and I don't have a diary. What I would say is, I seem to remember us booking out a month of time in the studio, and over the course of the month. And the end thing was we had a sort of secret, quote-unquote, gig at CBGB's where we kind of pulled all of the stuff out. So I think we booked a month with the goal of being ready for the secret gig. And we pulled everything together, And the funny thing was the song that became Lyra was just basically, I don't want to say a joke because it wasn't a joke, but it wasn't one of our more serious songs.
Mm-hmm.
But when we did the show at CBGB's, the head of the label literally came running up to us like, that song, it's a hit. And we're like, what song? And he's like, and so after that, I believe Henry sat down, we probably listened to the tape of the gig because it was CB's and it had a good sound system, and he listened to the lyrics he delivered that day. And, that's when he codified that part of the song.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we had no idea that was going to be the thing. It was just another thing that the band wrote.
Yeah. So the first Tubman album came out on Knitting Factory Works, and then the second one came out on John Zorn's Japanese label, Avant. You first worked with Zorn on The Big Gun Down in Spillane. So, like, how did you come into his world?
Well, as I said, I'll backtrack a bit. As we were talking about in the free funk thing, as I said, the root of all of that New York scene was the loft jazz scene, which, somebody needs to do a history of that connection. I should do it myself. I'm a little too lazy because I'm not running around doing all this research and people have moved to other countries and all kind of things now. But that was really, you had basically like the real musicians and the kind of, and the non-musicians and the wannabe musicians, you know what I mean? So, I mean, and I'm not even saying this as an insult, I'm just saying it as what it is. Like, you got the no-wish people who couldn't really play their instruments, but were actually trying to go for the thing that the loft jazz people were going for, but they were trying to figure out a way to hack it without having to go through the whole process of spending years learning how to play your instrument.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they were trying to get the flavor of it, the abstract version of it. And Zorn was a part of that too. And Zorn used to come around. I remember Zorn used to just basically troll people because Zorn would come through and play his duck calls at the loft jazz things. So you'd be there and it'd be like, Charles Tyler or whatever. Charles Tyler's buffing. And Zorn was in there playing his duck calls, everyone's playing music. And it was just kind of like, he was that guy.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew about me because, as you said, Laswell was you know, the guy who was making all the records. But I was the guy who was doing all the gigs. So there was, if you were doing music in that scene at that time, it was impossible that you wouldn't have known about me, or, you know, there's probably a bunch of people I don't even remember that I played with back then. But anyway, so that was the context of that. You know, so when he decided to put the group together, when he decided to put the band together for the Gundown, he called me in to play with the guitar players, you know, because he had Quine, and he had all the guys, Jody, you know, it was like all of the still kind of no wave-ish guitar players. So I was kind of the natural person to come do bass on that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And then on Spillane, you got to play with Albert Collins and Big John Patton. So, I mean, what was that experience like?
Oh, that was interesting, because it was, first of all, it was fun. I mean, Albert was a great guy. That was the only time I played with Big John. I didn't really know him, and that was fun. You know, I mean, the Harlem Organ thing, that's what I came up on. So it was kind of like, okay, I'm doing this again. But it was really interesting and actually really unique. I mean, I have a lot of respect for Zorn. Well, a lot of people, whatever, however, again, just like however anybody else feels about him is how they feel about him. And the reason I have a lot of respect for him was we did, if I remember correctly, we did two pieces that day. And one of the pieces was a classic kind of Zorn has written everything out and print too small to read and you kind of knock it out, right? Mm-hmm. The other piece we made up, and when the record came out, they both said composed by John Zorn on them. And I kind of bitched about it to a third party, you know? And before I had even had a chance to bitch directly to Zorn about it, I got a call from Zorn like, hey, I heard there's an issue with this, and he fixed it.
Huh.
So I'll always have respect for him because of that.
Yeah, yeah, because if you look that album up on Discogs, it says, you know, bass part composed by Melvin, organ part composed by John, you know, and like everybody gets credit for their individual contribution. So
yeah, and John, yeah, that, and that's why Zorn is the man, as far as I'm concerned. Because a lot of, you know, that's not the only time stuff like that has happened in my career, and it's one of the few times it got fixed.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me a little bit about how Araminta came together. Was that connection made when Brandon worked with Wadada a few years back, or what was the link there?
Yeah, I believe that's how it came together. Brandon, you know, a lot of the connections come through Brandon. And I guess we were decided to record, and Brandon reached out to Wadada, and Wadada said yes. And, you know, yeah, and I guess it's through the stuff they've been doing together over the years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No. And what did you see as the common ground necessarily between, you know, your music and his music? Like, how much negotiation was necessary, or how much did you guys communicate instantly, you know?
Oh, none. There's no negotiation. Like I said, I started off in New York with the AACM bad guys. You know what I mean? It's like that thing is just an inherent part of what I do, you know, and it's kind of like, even when you don't hear it, it's an inherent aspect of how I put my music here together. The specific system that Leo uses is a different issue, and that you'd have to sit with Leo and have him work through it. But as far as us coming together, I mean, that was easy, you know.
Mm. I'm kind of fascinated in a way by JT's role in Tubman, because he's this, you know, he's got this background, but he also has, you know, the, like, didn't he play with Lou Reed? And I know he plays with Vanessa Williams and stuff like that. So he's got that kind of mainstream rock, you know, pop rock drummer background as well. So how does that come into play with what, you know, with everything else that goes into Tubman?
Well, it comes into play more specifically in the lack of snobbery, you know. And it comes into play, like, if we play something that requires in the play a backbeat, it sounds like a real backbeat. It doesn't sound like some jazz guy's backbeat. You know? And, I mean, it's interesting now because we have, the new generation of jazz guys. They're, they're multilingual, right? So, but for our era, there was a lot of snobbery, But the flip side of that is, he comes from that. We all come, all of us, that era of like the great studio musicians that ended kind of like in the mid 80s or whenever, I guess the studio thing really kind of ended at 9/11. That's kind of when it really ended.
Mm-hmm.
But the 80s and 90s, all of the guys that that were doing all of those gigs, we all came up in rock bands. You know what I mean? JT, when in the Black Rock Coalition, the two bands that always played together was my band, I&I, and Sirius, which was Ronnie Drayton's band with Bernard Fowler, who sings with the Rolling Stones now, and JT.
Hmm.
So he's always had this, he's always been kind of like the rock dude. That was always the thing for, back when we were kids, the rivalry. The big rivalry was the Brooklyn musician versus the Queens musician. And the Queens guys were kind of like the rock. We were like the funk guys, and they were like the rock and roll guys. You know what I mean? It's JT, Eddie Martinez, who played on all the Rum DNC stuff. That's that whole crew of people.
Mm.
So that's kind of an inherent part. But the flip side of that is, they're all Jazzmobile people, too. They all came up through that. They had Weldon Irvine, who was the big kind of mentor out there. Artie Simmons, who mentored Billy Cobham. So it's always, for them, it's always been this dual thing. And JT kind of quickly became, he was like an A-level session dude, in New York. But I guess he liked doing gigs too, as much as session stuff. So I kind of lost the plot here. But just as far as his playing, yes, the thing about JT is that, if I remember correctly, JT's first touring gig was Stanley Turrentine, right?
Okay.
So JT can play jazz.
Mm-hmm.
But JT is a rocker, like you said, he played with Lou. He's on a lot of stuff, a lot of the rock stuff from that era. So he's very he's bilingual in that sense for sure.
Yeah. I feel like that shows up on the new record, because the new record is more aggressive than Araminta, I think. It's got bigger riffs, and he's playing harder on a lot of tracks. And early on I'm a Man, your music was kind of a cloudy, almost post-rock thing in certain ways, and now it's getting heavier. Do you see the same thing?
Well, it's interesting, because the main difference, I would say, is the curatorial aspect. Because we had Scotty come in, and Scotty, we did 2 days in the studio. And what ended up on the record was what Scotty thought was most interesting. And that's mm-hmm. the stuff he chose. So there's a lot of cloudy stuff in the sessions, but Scotty didn't think it was that interesting. So that's the stuff we pulled. So I think the result of that is, I think for me, I've always liked the riffy stuff. That's what I come from, and I'm a bass player. So that's my sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
But I think part of this has just been really focusing, because the thing with the gigs has always been, we kind of always go everywhere, right, during the course of a gig. And I think that one of the outcomes of this record is that maybe we're going to compartmentalize a little more, maybe if we do something that's cloudy, we'll do an hour of cloudy as opposed to 20 minutes of cloudy and then riff,
yeah.
So I think for me, the thing that I like about Scotty's curatorial choices is that he chose all the stuff I would have chosen. he went to what I think is one of the real strengths of the band, which is exactly what you said, the fact that we are, we play what people would call rock with a whole different, we put another, I don't want to say another spin, but we have another information source. So it's got a very unique quality to it. And I think that that kind of separating that out for a record or two is not a bad thing at all.
The new record, it's funny because a little while ago I tweeted, and I think you saw this too, is that, you know, we've all agreed that blackface isn't okay, but we're still letting white guys sing Redemption Song.
Yeah, I remember when you tweeted that.
And I said that because I heard a version by Chris Cornell that was just like full body cringe, you know. But
it's funny, I haven't heard Chris's version yet, and I kind of made a point of not listening to it. Because we like Chris Cornell, right?
Yeah, exactly. I like him too much to ever listen to that again. But there's a version on Terror End of Beauty, so what are your feelings about that song? Because I feel like they're probably different from mine.
Well, I mean, before I go into that, I got to go into my feelings about covers. You're never going to do Redemption Song as good as Bob Marley did.
Mm-hmm.
You're never gonna do Teen Spirit as good as Nirvana did, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're gonna play somebody else's song, it's to show what you bring to the table, not to try to reproduce what somebody else does. And that's kind of always how I've approached my thought process behind covers. And for me, as far as the band, there's an aspect of the band that doesn't, you know, came through much more on this record than it usually does, which is the kind of more spiritual side of what we do. I mean, we talk about it, but you don't really hear it because there's so much going on.
Mm-hmm.
And when Brandon was dealing with Cassandra, and he said he was doing it, and he kind of showed me the arrangement, I was kind of like, okay, we got to do this. I kind of somewhat forced the issue, you know what I mean? You get to do that once in a while in bands, you know what I mean? And when you got a band that's like a band and everybody has an opinion, everybody has an opinion. But once in a while, you pick your spots and you're kind of like, okay, we got to do this. And that was one of them. So, but as far as that song, yeah, I mean, because of the arrangement, I mean, but then even going back to what Brandon did for Cassandra back in the 90s with, you know, Last Train to Clarksville or whatever. He's an expert at doing that thing that I'm talking about, which is taking a song that's been trivialized, mm-hmm. which is what has happened to Redemption Song, and kind of breathing new life into it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's you know, I feel like we kind of did that with this.
When you were introducing the free jazz performance at Winter Jazz Fest, you talked about how, you know, your phrase was the universe had decided to care about Harriet Tubman. And so I guess my final question is, how much longer do you think the universe will care, and what are your plans in the interim?
That's an interesting. I don't know. The short answer is I don't know. I mean, about how much longer the universe will care. You know, they'll care. You know, the universe hopefully will care for another album or two at least, and then we got to make the universe care. And I think that I can't talk for the other guys with three different personalities. I think for me, well, there's two parts of this. Back when I was playing when we did the Power Tools tour, what was that, 88, 89?
Something like that, yeah.
I remember we were at a festival, and I'm pretty sure which one, but, you know, I don't want to. Whoever's the Phil Schaffer of this, I don't want them to come back and say, no, it wasn't that one. Anyway, we were at a jazz festival and Charles Lloyd's band was playing. And Charles Lloyd, I guess, was in his 50s at that point. And his audience was the same age as him. And I remember thinking to myself, man, I'm 29, you know. I should come back and do this music when I'm 50. And after the Power Tools tour, that's when I went and started doing the rock stuff. I mean, really. I mean, there's other reasons, but we won't get into now. But that is one of the main ones.
Mm-hmm.
I'm at that age now, you know what I mean, where I understand the purpose of the Charles Lloyds of the world, which is we have a lot of knowledge about life and that we can, and music that we can transmit. So for me at this point, I feel like that's my function, you know. I never really wanted to be this kind of like guru dude, you know, but I've been doing this a long time now, and I have a lot of information, and I have a lot of experience, and that is obviously what's useful. You know, it's interesting because, and I looked back at the interview we did for the Ascension record, and it's funny because I dropped his name then. I have a good friend who became an art star, like in the past 2 years, Arthur Jaffa, and Arthur has been a genius our whole adult lives. But 2 years ago, the rest of the world decided he was a genius. And when that happened, I was kind of like, oh, it's time. Our generation, it's taken 20, 25 years, but it's our generation's moment now. You know? So what I want to do with the moment is kind of expand on a lot of the stuff I've been thinking about musically. You know, I've been working on the last couple of years, I've been working on a project, a collaboration with a scientist, a man named Stefan Alexander, who wrote the book The Jazz of Physics that came out, I guess, 3 years ago now. And we've been doing a bunch of stuff, you know. And one of those has been a collaboration with a visual artist named Justin Gariglia, who's the embedded artist with NASA, who's documenting climate change. So I want to move off into that. I did my first kind of art show last year, you know, up at the Gavin Brown Enterprise. And I'm doing at least one Biennale this year. I'm doing one in Belgium, where I'm moving off into that world, you know, because when you're working with ideas, you know, that the art world tends to be a better venue for working with, not better, but a fruitful venue for working with ideas when you're going to come to music.
Yeah.
And I mean, I want to get a few records out this year while people give it in. You know what I mean? I want to get out. You know, I want to do my Magnum project, which is basically, you know, dealing a lot of these ideas that I've had about dealing with modern rhythms. You know, so I'm going to work on that. You know, I want to put my little brain trust together. You know, it's my basic crew of, Casa overall, and Paul Wilson, you know, and bring Jace, be DJ Logic into it to help, you know, for stuff that works. Something else I've been talking about that I'm going to make these guys do is me, Vijay, Aya, and Kokai have been talking about doing a project together for years. And I don't know if you know who Kokai is.
No, I don't know.
He's a rapper, producer, and he's been with the Five Elements lately, and he's like one of the OG kind of like Washington DC rappers, not OG, but like, you know, because that he's not that old and his music is still current, but he's kind of like the godfather, one of the godfathers of the Washington DC hip-hop scene. And so I've been wanting to do some stuff with do like a full-fledged project with the trio project with the two of them. And, you know, get out a couple of the records that have been sitting, you know, the Melvin Runs the Hoodoo Down record, the record that I did with Pete back in the day. I got to get that out this year. So there's a few things I'm going to run through there as far as getting stuff out while people care, and then hopefully exposing people to how I think about this music, because it tends to hidden in the process of making it, that there's a thought process behind it. And I think that's the thing, that's why guys like Henry and Dre Gill and Wadada are vital, because their process kind of transcends them, you know. And I feel, you know, a lot of the elders spent time, you know, teaching me and Brandon and JT these things, and I think it's kind of our duty to kind of spread them, you know.
Yeah, because there's so much, I mean, there is so much that gets lost sometimes. I mean, I think about how much music Cecil Taylor wrote and performed. You know, like, you would look and, like, he'd be at the Knitting Factory one year with a 25-piece orchestra, you know, and then the next year he'd have a completely new band, and then the next year he'd have a completely new band, and there was new music for all those bands, none of which was ever recorded, you know, none of which was ever transmitted to the world in a permanent way. Like, if you weren't there, you missed it, you know?
Yeah.
His catalog could have been easily double the size it is if anybody had been willing to shave off some money and throw it at him.
Yeah, and that's always the thing. Get, you know, going back to the Laswell thing, that was Laswell's agency was the one who got people to shave off the money. You know, and now there's no money because the streaming, you're never going to stream enough Cecil Taylor records to pay for an orchestra. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So, how you get the money is the big thing right now. Yeah, it is the big thing. But yeah, I mean, it's funny, you know, because a lot that traditionally was part of it, that if you weren't there, you missed it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's funny, you know, even with me, there's a couple of, you know, I have friends who still talk about certain gigs they were at where I played that, you know, you ain't never gonna hear, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of funny, you see, you know, certain quotes about me, and people are kind of like, we don't hear that, and it's because you weren't there. The people who were there are telling you, but that used to be what the music was back then. You had to be there. It was, but we're just in a different era right now. So
yeah,
I mean, we got making it work now requires you to document things. It requires you to be in the conversation. You know, it can't just be that, you know, I went to, you know, I'm kicking it with Arnett and Arnett told me something about, you know, how to do this, or Arnett shared something with me, and I just kind of put it in my music, and I get to keep that info to myself. It just doesn't work that way anymore.
Yeah,
it's kind of like you kind of gotta share. And I think that that's a good thing, and I think that's why we're seeing this kind of critical mass of new music, because of the fact that what's out there, people are digesting, and they're trying to figure out where to go with it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of my things has always been that music, to a certain extent, died when the sampler was invented. So what people are doing right now is in the process of kind of reconstructing music. so you have these people that everybody's kind of in the late 70s right now, you know.
Yeah.
They're moving towards the 80s, you know.
Yeah.
And at a certain point they'll get to about 83-84 where Wynton killed the music, and then it will start. Then we'll see something really. Then we'll see what the new music actually sounds like.
Mhm. Mhm.
Cuz I think it's really that archaeological, you know.
Yeah.
But the other thing that's interesting for me, and I was thinking about that today, is that music is always on this 20-year loop, right? So when you're looking at, I mean, that's kind of the heuristic for how you're trying to figure out how to make a track. Okay, what was hot 20 years ago? Let me make the modern version of that. So we're looking at 99 next year. And 99 was a crazily fertile year in New York. But none of it got documented, because that was the height of the kind of like jazz police, y'all don't mess with this young music thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to me, you know, the guys of my generation, if they just go back and literally made the same record they would have made 20 years ago, they'd be right on point. So it would be interesting to see how many guys actually just go ahead and do that. You know, it's kind of like, because it's kind of a no-brainer when you don't, you know, because that's the thing about pop music. You got to think about, okay, what do people want? But at this point, that's the thing that's great about jazz. I mean, I don't even say great, but that's the thing. That's part of the reason why, you know, somebody like me is, at my age, is still vital and valid, is that my kind of like the things I thought about 20 years ago that are now in the conversation. So I have like, I'm not just going to be making a record. I've been thinking about this stuff for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
you know. So it's got, you know, I could, you know, and that's kind of what happened with AJ. It's kind of like with Arthur Jaffa. It's like he came out with this thing and everybody was amazed by it. But he's been thinking about this for 25 years. So everything he does is amazing because he's not going to fail because he's filtered through all his ideas already.
Yeah, yeah.
With me, as far as what I want to do with connecting, you know, the current rhythms with jazz, you know, some of it's, you know, it's, I'm going to use the Mingus Workshop model. I got to figure out how to digitize that. It's not all going to be like amazing. And, you know, there's going to be some alpha versions of some of these things, but there's certain rhythmic ideas that I really want to explore. And I want to, you know, and, you know, Father Unknown was kind of like 1.0 of that, you know what I mean? Or 0.1 of that, you know, just really how to insert the rhythmic. And again, I'm jumping around a little bit. The other thing is that, which is interesting, you know, Beans, was it Beans or Priest from Antipop, tweeted out that the big thing right now is for people to rap over, you know, Cold Flow beats or old Antipop beats, right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, because of that 20-year loop that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
The other thing that's happened is drum and bass has made a comeback. So it's all of that information from that, you know, my crew was thinking about then. I think we're going to see, you know, it's going to be interesting, you know. And, you know, I kind of feel like if people can get the if people can solve the resource issue, which took them a long time to solve, frankly. I mean, it's funny because, I mean, all the usual suspects were like, nah. And it's, you know, that's why I said, you know, the universe decided to give a damn. It's like, the same people I'm looking at in the audience, y'all didn't want to know, you know. But then you can't even really be mad because it's like, the culture had to move. It's a cultural thing. It's not even really about us on a certain level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but to your point, the culture is going to keep moving, and then the light's going to shine somewhere else. And where are we when the light shines somewhere else? And for me, I think it's really about getting some of these ideas that I've been sitting on out there and kind of letting people know that that's a part of who I am.
Yeah, know? Yeah. I think what's happening now is now that the music industry is a smoking crater, I think what's important and what people haven't fully realized yet is that the stardom model is long gone. It was never going to happen anyway, but now there's not even the dream that it might happen. So the model now, it seems to me, is sustainability. Find the 1,000 people in the world that really, really love what you do and cater to them. You know?
Well, that's always kind of been that's been the jazz model for a while. The problem was that, well, let me not put it that way because I don't want to beat that. Yeah, I will put it that way. The people, the gatekeeping aspect of it. I mean, people got in and they were kind of like, okay, we're in. So to ensure that our 1,000 people keep us, you know, sustained, we're going to make sure that they don't know about anybody else but us. You know? Mm-hmm. And I think that has proven to be unsustainable, you know.
Yeah.
It's interesting, haven't said that, because it looks like Wayne Shorter, I mean, I don't want to put a negative, but the question does become, what happens in 10 years or 20 years when the guys that are the epitome of what we think of as jazz are no longer able to sustain the music,
mm-hmm.
you know? So to that extent, it's good that there are organizations that are tasked to sustain the music, that music, and those organizations are supported. The flip side of that is that it's just as good that there are 20-somethings that are interfacing with this music that don't care about what 60-year-olds think about the music.
Right.
It's good. Both of these things are good.
Mm-hmm.
I always, you know, to kind of flip it, I always talk, you know, talking with, you know, with African American men about mentoring kids, you know, it always comes up when it comes to the question of these kids, those kids, and I always have the same response. There's no those kids, those are our kids. It's our responsibility to reach out. It's not their responsibility to reach out to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's our responsibility to reach out to them.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, and coming up, that's why I'm a musician, because the generation before us decided that it was their responsibility to reach out to us.
Mm-hmm. You know? And institutionally, like you say, like a guy like Wayne, a guy like Herbie, those guys are getting old, you know? So, like, chronologically, they're getting old. So it's time for Jazz at Lincoln Center, somebody should hand them James Brandon Lewis's phone number, you know? Somebody should hand them Darius Jones's phone number and be like, this is who you're going to need 10 years from now. So get in touch now. Make friends now, you know?
Because it becomes that resource pipe. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like you couldn't make a certain analogy between that's unfair. I don't need to troll. Flip side of that, this is why it's great that Jason Moran is doing what he's doing. We do have people. Yeah, let me keep it positive. That's the great thing about, we do have somebody like Jason who's making these connections, who's establishing on a very high level that what jazz looks like now is not what it looked like 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So in the context of New York City, we don't have a person like that. And, you know, the New York scene needs, you know, I mean, I actually get a little jealous when I see what's happening in London and happening in Chicago, because New York scene is just not, it's not keeping up.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah, well, Chicago's always been that communal vibe. I mean, it started with the AACM, and then in the 90s with Vandermark and all those guys working together. You know, it's always been a we're all in this together kind of a thing, whereas in New York it's always been, hey, I got a gig, I'll bring my friends and everybody else can fuck off, you know?
Well, there was two factors to that, though, I have to say. I mean, with that, currently, there's a problem. Like, if there's a scene, one person gets picked as the figurehead of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like, with M-Base, it was Steve, right? Regardless of the fact that Jerry Allen and Osby and Cassandra were all in it, John Paul, all of them were in it, but Steve got picked as the figurehead, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, back in the Illbian era, DJ Spooky got picked, you know what I mean? So, that's tends to be the problem in New York more, that you get like somebody who gets made the representative of a scene, and the scene itself doesn't get the same life. I mean, but for me, it really was, I mean, I was actively trying to fought, even with Tubman, we always, you know, it's kind of like we always bringing people in, right? That's part of the reason the Ascension record, you know, Free Jazz, we're always trying to make this thing more communal, because that's traditionally what jazz was. I mean, everybody was on everybody else's gig, and that's what kept it going.
Mm-hmm.
But the guys, my generation guys, we just, you know, it's a bunch of things. Venues, you know, like I was talking to somebody in the city of New York when they were doing the meetings about what to do about music in New York. And I said the same thing to them that I've been saying for years. I mean, scenes are anchored by venues. If we don't have a venue where we can sit and consistently make this music, we're not going to have a scene. You know? So there's a bunch of things that make the problem. But I think, you know, in 2018, I just really want to see us here. There's a bunch of places. I want to see the people in Atlanta come up. There's a bunch of things that are happening that aren't getting supported, because there's a whole set of guys down in Atlanta that have been doing their thing for a while. The LA guys managed, you know, they had Flying Lotus as the focal point, so and then they had the Kendrick connection, so that whole scene was able to come up like at once. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I don't know, we're not going to get that kind of critical mass in New York, so I don't know what's going to make it happen, but I really could be something similar in Atlanta, where all those guys who are living down there have some critical mass with a rapper or something, and then everybody wants to see what all of them are doing. But there's a lot of people who've been, you know, as you know, we've been plowing this field for 20 years. There's been people who've been plowing it for 10, the guys in my band ended up in Stephon Harris's band, for example. He's been plowing the field for 10 years. You know, there's a bunch of people who've been looking at what is the new iteration of jazz look like, that kind of I want to see everybody like out there right now. And I also want to see the great geniuses supported too. You know, it's like, I think there's room for it all.
Okay. That was my conversation with Melvin Gibbs, and I want to thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll consider becoming a supporter of Burning Ambulance. Again, it's just $5 a month, and that gets you more podcast content and the occasional subscribers-only article on the website as well. Please go to patreon.com/burningambulance to become a supporter.
Osiris.